What have you done?
Can you dig it? This is the Hall of Fame on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Booker T and Brad Gilmore.
Joins me now, Michael. How you doing, man?
Good, glad to be here.
Hey, you know what? I'm sure you're glad that finally Loki is out and you can actually talk about it, right?
I'm very, very glad. I have a few less things I can say that get me killed. It's good.
I'm sure it's been like a whirlwind just having, you know, I think out of the initial batch of those Disney Plus shows, Loki, probably like the most popular character in the MCU of the first slate. I think you can make an argument for any of them, but Loki just has ties back to that first Avengers movie, first Thor movie. So let's start kind of there. Like, how do you feel about the reaction to Loki, though? How do you feel about it? I mean, people seem to be blown away by that final episode.
Dude, it's, you know, humbled, grateful, relieved. If we had blown it at the end, you know, you don't want to recontextualize the legacy of the show in a negative way. But yeah, I feel very, you know, I'm just humbled that people watched and cared so much, and I'm glad we brought it into the station.
Did you know there was going to be a season two when y'all started production, or did you get that note, you know, halfway through the process?
It was something that evolved. I think we always knew it was a possibility. You know, but it was our goal to tell a complete story with this season and something that could stand alone. And that would propel Loki into a new chapter of his story in the MCU one way or another.
So you shoot this thing, people are anticipating it, you can't say anything, this is MCU, it's like Fort Knox, the vault is locked, you can't get in. Was there like a single scene or a moment or a reveal, something that you had written that you couldn't wait for people to see so you could talk about it?
I mean, man, I was stoked for everybody to see Jonathan Majors as He Who Remains. That was the, you know, knowing that we had that ace up our sleeve, that we were going to really deliver on that, and that in fact that was kind of the meat of the finale, was meeting that character. That one I always felt good about. That and Alligator Loki.
Well, Alligator Loki won the internet. Did you? Yeah. I didn't like, when I was watching the episode, I thought it was awesome to see an Alligator Loki, but I never thought that would be the number one trending topic the next morning on Twitter.
I knew that was my vision. My real talent as a writer is knowing what's stupid. I'm like the Oracle at the end of the Matrix. I didn't know, but I believe.
Yeah, I mean, everybody obviously, I mean, loved the show. And the last episode, what I loved is you had like this buildup of these huge action moments. You know, even the episode before, that big action at the end. And then the final episode was more of a conversation between characters. It wasn't this grandiose, you know, set pieces, big action moments. It was very, very small kind of in its, it was small, but it was big at the same time. Was that intentional to have like a real, you know, kind of characters having conversations in the final episode?
Absolutely. It felt like in a lot of ways that had been kind of the bread and butter of the show throughout. Certainly those were my favorite parts, were just the conversations. It mirrored the first episode in a way that, you know, it was just Loki and Mobius sitting in a room, cross-examining one another. And we had just done the big, you know, the big kind of action episode in our penultimate episode, episode 5. And so it felt like it was an opportunity to just, yeah, do something more intimate and build tension in a totally different way.
So, I mean, you had the TVA, you know, time travel, obviously essential in this story. For me, I mean, my favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future. I love it so much. I wrote a book about it last year. When you do any time travel story, that's the first thing that people compare it to, right? Back to the Future. When you were writing this time travel story, did you have any other time travel movies in your mind of how they handle time travel? Or did you say, look, we're just going to kind of go off what Endgame did and try to, you know, add on top of that?
Well, I think you try to have everything in your head, certainly Back to the Future. Looper was something I thought about a lot that I thought did a great job of anything that explained time travel in a way that was practical. That's what I like about Back to the Future is Doc Brown's a scientist and he's like, look, here's how it works. There's a practicality to it because it was the TVA. That was what we always said in the writer's room is time travel is not magic. It is paperwork. It represents procedure and bureaucracy in our show and everything. And so I just tried to really draw inspiration from anything that sought to, you know, explain time travel and treat it as a real thing, as a real element of the story it was in.
So you, before you did Loki, obviously you did episodes of Rick and Morty, writing episodes of that, which is a, you know, almost a playoff Back to the Future. It is a playoff Back to the Future. And there's the interdimensional travel in that show. Was that kind of what got you on the radar to do Loki? You're writing for that? Or how did you kind of get tapped to be the guy?
Yeah, that certainly helped, that credit. And then I had written a time travel kind of action rom-com that got on the blacklist, which is just a list of screenplays at the end of the year that have kind of generated some buzz around town. And that just happened to be the perfect sample because it was about kind of a time traveling rascally character that you know, and that obviously Marvel wanted to do a time traveling show about Loki. So it was sort of right place, right time.
And when writing it, did you feel, because I want to talk about Heels here in a second, which I absolutely loved. I got to watch the first few episodes today. But when you were writing for the Marvel show, you know, they have very specific things historically. Like, we need this to lead up to go to this, right? I mean, Kevin Feige's thinking down the road. Did you find any of those to kind of constrain your creative process? Or were you okay working within those borders? It actually kind of made the challenge kind of made it all that much more fun.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. That was always, there really aren't constraints, truly. It's, you know, there's a roadmap.
Sure.
That's an offer to you for places to go and cool things to pull from and build to. But the charge is always make your thing the best it can be. Make something awesome. And that's, you know, so yeah, I really felt a lot of freedom doing that.
So now next up though, and you're able to talk about Loki, but you're not able to talk about the next thing, this Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness. Now you're going from Disney Plus, kind of you getting time, 6 episodes, a lot of time to tell a story, at least the size of Loki. Now you're gonna have to kind of, you know, constrain that, I guess, in some regards to a two hour plus film. How has it been like? I know you can't give anything away, but how has it been like having to write that script and going through that creative process?
It's been a pleasure, man. I mean, it's Sam Raimi directing it. So it's been, you know, that's been the coolest thing in the world, working with Sam and that whole team, Benedict and the cast is just fantastic. And yeah, it's, you know, on one hand, it's less space than a 6 hour story, but with Loki, we really worked hard to make sure every episode stood on its own. And so that, you know, that's what you want a movie to do as well. And so you attack it in a similar way and ultimately you just trust your instincts that, you know, a good story is a good story, no matter how long it is.
Well, I mean, obviously Loki was just great. Everybody loved it. I'm sure the train will roll on for Doctor Strange, but I see you wearing the hat. Let's talk about Heels. We got to talk about Heels. The show that you created, you wrote, pro wrestling has been something that I've loved my entire life. I've gotten to work in pro wrestling for the last 9 years under, you know, WWE Hall of Famer Booker T here for his independent promotion in Houston, working with the Reality of Wrestling. And it's, I mean, tailor-made for a drama, for a sitcom, for a cinematic experience, whether it be on the small screen or the big screen. What was the genesis of this? Were you always a wrestling fan and had this idea in the back of your head, or did you kind of stumble along this along your way?
No, man, I was a diehard wrestling fan. I was watching Booker T and Stevie Ray, Harlem Heat back in the day. No, I mean, I was diehard wrestling fan my whole life. And so the show came out of a real affection for the world and yeah, feeling the same thing that, holy shit, this is right for a show, you know, and something that we tried to convey in the show is that, yes, these guys are tremendous athletes, but they're, I think first and foremost, they're artists, they're performers, they're storytellers. And it's a wrestling is a creative endeavor. And that's a really compelling thing to get to write a story about.
One of the things that you touched on the show, like obviously not to give anything away, but there's so many guys who can be something inside the ring, maybe a larger than life character that everybody loves. And then behind the curtain, when they go to their real lives, there's this great duality that they have to play. Maybe they're playing a baby face, but they're not the greatest of person. Maybe they're playing a heel, but they're really the good guy trying to hold everything together. Was that kind of a thing that you like to play with when you were writing the show?
Yeah, absolutely. That living up to the expectations of who you are in the ring and, you know, just identity, you know, it's easy to go out into the ring and be the good guy and you know, and get the cheers and everything. It's a different thing to be a good person, in your daily life and to make the choices that make you a face in reality. That's all rich, compelling stuff, I think, you know, and part of what drives the show.
Did you like have to go to any independent promotions when you were writing this show? Because I got to tell you, you really nail it, because there's a moment in the first episode where I'll just say one of the characters makes a purchase for the show. They make a purchase and the wife comes to him and was like, hey, you know, you should have talked to me first before you made this big purchase. And he's like, I needed it for the show. We need it for the show. I've literally seen this exact scene play out umpteenth amount of times at Reality of Wrestling between Booker and his wife, Charmel. So did you have to go to any promotions, or did you go to any promotions to kind of feel out what the process is for a show this size? For people listening, it's not like the DWL is the WWE. It's a smaller promotion in a, you know, Georgia hometown kind of feel to it. So how did you capture that?
Yeah. I mean, it was going to promotions and in some game, you know, just over the course of my life, I've been to different small town promotions and stuff, watching documentaries, there's so much content online and just getting a feel for the production value for anything, you know, behind the scenes, reading, listening to podcasts and all of the shoot interviews and everything. And it's like, you know, and then just approximating it into my own, you know, if I was starting up, you kind of have to become a promoter yourself, and start your own promotion and you just let the story take you where it takes you.
At the heart of this show, though, it's you know, obviously it covers the pageantry of pro wrestling, but it is a family drama, and so many independent wrestling promotions are small family businesses. Some of them have been handed down from generation to generation. You even take to WWE. This is Vince McMahon has got it from his dad, who got it from his grandfather. So at the heart of these promotions, a lot of them are just family businesses. Is that kind of another thing that attracted you? Of, I can tell this story about the, you know, this promotion, but really it's the family drama.
Absolutely. It's a great family drama. It's also a great workplace drama. You know, it's a mixture of the two best kinds of shows to me, which would, you know, a family drama and then the surrogate family workplace drama. And so, yeah, the family business aspect of it, it's stranger than fiction. You can't believe that these stories are real, but they are.
Was there any inspiration, like real life inspiration, between some of the characters? You know, even the veteran who left the promotion, went up north, and now is a talent scout. Did you base these guys on anyone?
I think they're all, you know, they're all in their own ways, inspired by different wrestlers that I grew up loving, and they have different, you know, qualities, good and bad, you know, aesthetically, emotionally, or otherwise. It's like, yeah, you kind of pull from all the different wrestlers and just personalities in this world, of which there are so many big ones, and you put them in a stew and see what comes out.
Now, I heard Quentin Tarantino talk one time when he was writing, I believe it was his last movie, Once Upon a Time. He wrote it with Brad Pitt and Leo in mind. He said, when I was writing these characters, I saw them in my head when I was making this movie. Was Stephen Amell that for you? Because to me, he was the perfect fit for this. When you think of, you know, not only Arrow, he can do the action thing. He has the look of a pro wrestler, but he's also a massive fan who's wrestled, actually, for promotions, including WWE, wrestled a match at SummerSlam a few years ago. Did you write with him in mind, or how did he become part of the process?
No, I mean, I first wrote this pilot in 2013 when I was an intern on Rick and Morty.
Oh, wow.
I didn't really write it. I just wrote it with the prayer that it would help me buy food eventually as in mind. And I kind of know, I think in this case, I didn't cast it in my head. That felt like that would just, I was embarrassed to do that at the time because I was just such a nobody. Maybe I have the luxury of doing that a little bit more now. But Steven, you know, when we got him, that's when the show fell into place. And Alexander, you know, that this show, perhaps more than others, would not work without the very specific casting. There has to be such a precise alchemy of just great acting ability, but also just pure physicality. And to have found Steven and Alexander, who have both in spades, pun I guess intended, we're very fortunate.
Yeah, I will say that Stephen Amell and Alexander, they both crush it in their main roles, really liked it. And for me, I'll be honest, whenever you hear, hey, they're making a wrestling show or they're making a wrestling movie, as a lifelong wrestling fan, someone who has a deep respect for the industry working in it, you get a little hesitant. You're like, oh, you know, what are they going to do? Is this going to be another one of those, oh, wrestling's this circus? Can you believe these wild animals? And I really do appreciate that it felt like you have a reverence. I mean, you felt that in the show. There's a deep respect and admiration for what these guys and girls go out there and do, because a lot of people, even there's a scene where someone calls it fake, and it's like, look, guys, we got to know what these guys and girls actually put their bodies through. And you said it's a performance. And I really do appreciate the reverence that you had for the industry. It was felt within the show and the writing. And the writing's very... It clicks for me in certain respects where I hear certain terms like, oh, yeah, he went up north, or they're going to put him in developmental. These are things that guys actually say that even the hardcore fans will pick up on. Maybe the layman doesn't know what you're talking about on the first watch, but the hardcores pick it up. So I do appreciate you throwing that in for us.
Yeah. You want it to, you obviously want to capture the authenticity of what is a very specific world with a very specific language. At the same time, you want to invite in an audience who doesn't know anything about wrestling to learn about it and to fall in love with it. And so you're always trying to strike that balance. And that was something that, you know, I worked closely with our writing staff and then our showrunner, Mike O'Malley, you know, as they brought this thing into production, they did a great job just continuing to build out the episodes with those little bits that just make it feel that much more real.
Yeah, of course, Heels is going to be on Stars here coming up very soon. You can check that out. And Loki on Disney Plus. My last question for you is pro wrestling related. You said you're a lifelong fan. Who's your Rushmore? Who's your top four all time pro wrestlers?
Top four. All right, I gotta go Sting.
Okay.
Shawn Michaels.
I like it.
That's an easy...
Those are two good, solid bases there.
Yeah, that's an easy top two. I think Punk.
Wow.
I love him. I've gotten to know him personally, so we're past, sure. You know, but I just, you know, some of those, God, the pops in the Cena match where he won the title. It's like, those are some of the best pops ever. And then I don't know, I guess I got to go Stone Cold just in terms of, you know, pure enjoyment. Who's brought me so much joy. I love Stone Cold.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good top four. So CM Punk, Stone Cold, Shawn Michaels, and Sting. I can live with that, Michael. I can live with that. And hopefully we see
CM Punk. Who's yours?
Man, well, see, for me, I think the quintessential pro wrestler, like the greatest, where he checks all the boxes, you know, character, promo, in-ring ability, the entrance. To me, it's the Macho Man, Randy Savage. I put him up way high on the list. I think he's the quintessential pro wrestler. Shawn Michaels is on there as well for me. You have to put Steve Austin, and then I would probably go The Undertaker.
I think it's hard because Undertaker and also Flair.
Flair, yeah.
Yeah, it's just those, you know, I almost need six spots because those guys, watching The Undertaker as a little kid, there was nothing cooler in the world than that bell ringing.
Oh, yeah. You're right with those two. It's almost like if you ever have the like the top five dead or alive rappers, you say, okay, without Biggie or Tupac, let's put them to the side and then let's debate the rest of it. So that's kind of Taker and Flair has done. So again, the show is great. And thank you for bringing pro wrestling to the mainstream and treating it with respect and reverence. I think that every wrestling fan is going to love this show. Just like every Marvel fan loved Loki, and we appreciate you for taking some time and talking to me today, Michael.
Thanks, man.
All right, have a good one. That is Michael. The show is called Heels and Loki. You can get on Disney Plus and Stars. We'll be back in a minute.